previously on The Dropout. Theranos' former lab director spoke of his grave concerns about the company's practices and technology.
So you go to Elizabeth's office, and what did you say to her?
We really need to perform proficiency because it's been almost a year, so we're in violation.
In court, he testified about his warnings to a nervous Elizabeth not to go forward with a Walgreens launch before he says the technology was ready.
The question will be, did she have enough information so that her representations can be deemed to be fraudulent and with an intent to defraud?
This week, the heated cross-examination concludes, and we hear from a veteran Silicon Valley investor who puts the Theranos debacle in larger context. From ABC Audio, this is The Dropout, Elizabeth Holmes on Trial. Episode 8, Crime and Punishment. In a trial filled with unexpected disruptions, this week proved no different. This time, it came from the jury pool. When juror number 4, a woman who'd originally disclosed that English was her second language, came forward with some troubling news. The juror informed the court she'd been having anxiety about the issue of punishment. Specifically, juror number 4 said her religion, Buddhism, preached love, forgiveness, and compassion. The notion she could be responsible for Elizabeth Holmes spending years in prison was almost too much to bear. I would be so sad if Elizabeth would have to be in there for a long, long time. And then I am out here. Juror number 4 said. She said she feared her vote would impact Elizabeth's future, something she couldn't square with her religious beliefs. Judge Davila reminded juror 4 it was not for the jury to set the terms of punishment, only to make a determination of guilt. But juror 4 said the decision weighed too heavily. I would think about it all the time, every day in my life, she said, and would feel like it's my fault, and feel guilty for that. Judge Davila thanked juror number 4 for her candor. And after she left the courtroom, he turned to the attorneys to get their assessment. Prosecutor Jeffrey Schenck asked the judge to excuse her. These are sincerely held beliefs that are causing a significant amount of stress and anxiety, he said. Defense attorney Kevin Downey didn't directly request an excusal, but also said he wouldn't stand in the way of it. Santa Clara University law professor Ellen Kreitzberg says both sides potentially had a lot to lose by keeping this juror.
Where she expressed concern about whether Elizabeth Holmes would be incarcerated after this trial, the defense may be thinking she may be finding the defendant guilty. She may be finding the evidence of guilt more compelling. But the government's also going to be worried, while she may find the evidence compelling, her religious beliefs may prevent her from ultimately casting the vote for guilt. Both sides had something to gain and something to lose by this particular juror.
So juror number 4 was dismissed. She's now the second juror to leave the trial. According to Kreitzberg, it's something the court will have to keep in mind going forward.
We're only a few weeks into the trial, and we've now lost our second juror. It's not great drama yet, but everyone's going to be very mindful of the fact that jurors are starting to leave.
It seemed everything was ready to move forward. But when juror number 4's replacement, alternate number 2, was brought in, surprisingly, she happened to raise similar concerns. Alternate number 2 began with a reminder that from the beginning, she told the court English wasn't her first language. She said she worried she could make a mistake because of this, and the stakes were simply too high to take that risk. It's her future, she said, pointing to Elizabeth in the courtroom.
Both used the word, the future of Elizabeth Holmes, and just the use of that word was sort of interesting to me that they both used it. As the case became more significant and they became more involved, the enormity of what they're being asked to do or will be asked to do starts weighing on them.
Judge Davila told alternate juror number 2 it was normal to feel nervous. He reminded her what she'd said in jury selection about the language barrier. I think you told me you're following things. You're able to understand, he said. He told her her representation was vital. This is a country created from immigrants, and we respect and enjoy our communities that are made up by this rich, rich collection of individuals. He said she'd be serving the community by sitting on the jury.
You felt almost that music should be playing in the background with the patriotic but heartfelt conversation. The judge implored the juror. The fact that the juror has a first language that's not English only brings an additional richness to the trial. And as long as the juror was able to understand all the testimony, which she said she was, that juror should be willing to and able to participate on the jury.
He also told alternate juror number two, as he told the excused juror before her, not to have concerns about punishment, as it was her job to decide facts. You may not decide punishment in any way. That's forbidden, he said. Does that give you some more confidence, or does that give you some reassurance about your continued service as a juror? Judge Davila asked. Yes, sir, she responded. Despite her concerns, everyone agreed alternate juror number two would stay, taking the place of juror number four. Here's Ellen Kreitzberg again.
We still have three alternates who are left and able to serve if jurors have to leave. And the judge will be very careful going forward about whether or not jurors are going to be excused or not. So this case is a long way from any kind of mistrial. A mistrial is only going to become an issue when we start getting to the last 12 jurors and we have no more alternates.
Once the jury issues were settled, the defense wrapped up its seemingly endless cross-examination of Theranos' former lab director, Dr. Adam Rosendorf, which went on for the better part of 6 days. Defense attorney Lance Wade tried to downplay Dr. Rosendorf's warnings ahead of the Walgreens launch, calling it a soft launch for friends and family. Those are patients, Dr. Rosendorf forcefully responded, later telling prosecutor John Bostick, soft launch was not a term he'd ever heard used in reference to medical or laboratory testing. Wade raised doubts about why Rosendorf left Theranos. Was it because something problematic was going on there, or because he got a more lucrative offer somewhere else? Rosendorf said, it was a question of my integrity as a physician not to remain there and to continue endorsing results that I essentially didn't have faith in. In the redirect, the prosecution asked Dr. Rosendorf to compare his experience at 6 labs in his 13 years to his time at Theranos, including places he'd worked at after Theranos. Were the problems that you saw at Theranos in line with what you would expect to see at any laboratory, he was asked. No, he answered. Were they worse than that? Yes, he answered. At any other laboratory, did you ever resort to forwarding evidence to your personal email account because you worried about future investigations into lab practices? No, he responded. The defense fumed over this line of questioning, saying the government violated a previous ruling in which both sides agreed not to question Rosendorf on his experience at non-Theranos labs. You can't unring the bell with the jury, Wade argued. The damage, he said, may have already been done. Judge Davila seemed to have lost patience too, warning he didn't want to see a mini trial and that the jury had endured 5 days of examination already. Wade responded, I think we all have, Your Honor. Judge Davila ultimately defused the situation by telling the court to strike the prosecution's last question and Rosendorf's reply to it from the record.
It was interesting that Judge Davila started making comments about the length of his testimony. It's a little bit out of character for this judge. It's always done in a very polite manner, but I think it expresses what everybody else felt of you have more than amply explored the issues and attacked the credibility of this witness.
The whole thing came as a surprise to 16-year-old Emma Rogers, who, sitting in court with her mom, watched it all unfold.
Like, I thought everyone would be very, like, hands folded. This is a very serious court proceeding, but a couple people were, like, sarcastic and, like, made jokes. I think it was Mr. Wade. He said, like, can you confirm that this email sent in September came after this email that was sent in August? And Dr. Rosendorf goes, yes, September does come after August. And everyone kind of laughed. And I'm like, wow, okay.
Emma was attending the trial as an assignment for her government class at nearby Los Gatos High School.
We had this thing called political participation, where we were supposed to observe basically something having to do with the government. And then also some of the English teachers have actually assigned your podcast, The Dropout, as like assigned listening. And so I just thought that would be a really interesting thing to do for my project.
But that's not Emma's only connection to this story.
In the atmosphere of my high school, we've had, of course, Mr. Alex Schultz as a former biology teacher. He retired last year. He taught both biology and biology honors. And he's Tyler Schultz's father, and of course, George Schultz's son.
That's right. The son of Theranos board member George Schultz and the father of Theranos whistleblower Tyler Schultz was a biology teacher at Emma's school. It's the kind of connection you see a lot of in Silicon Valley. With such a monumental story unfolding so close to home, Emma says she can't help but imagine the longer-term implications for her community.
You're a young person living in Silicon Valley right now. What will the takeaway be for people like you?
Well, I think definitely if she gets off, people are going to be like, wow, a company could do something that bad. Because it's pretty much accepted, at least where I live, that like she's guilty. Like, that's what people think. And I'm sure that'll lead some people to think that maybe they can start their own fraudulent company someday. So that would be bad. But I think if she's convicted, then people will think like, okay, there is, you know, there's justice. If you have like a fraud, then that's going to be the punishment.
This is Brad Milkey, host of ABC's daily news podcast, Start Here. More Dropout in a minute, but first.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
A quick reminder, if you're looking for a daily recap of the day's news, including updates on the Elizabeth Holmes trial, join me over on Start Here, the daily podcast from ABC News. Again, that's Start Here, available wherever you listen.
As the story of Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes has been unfolding in Emma's backyard, it's been hard to look away this week from the other big tech and startup stories unfolding in our collective backyard. From the Facebook whistleblower coming forward.
I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy.
To allegations that startup Ozy Media faked its numbers while soliciting investors, as New York Times media columnist Ben Smith reported.
According to the New York Times, the company's chief operating officer impersonated a YouTube executive on a call with Goldman Sachs while attempting to raise money from the investment bank.
Carlos Watson, Ozy's co-founder, appearing in an interview on CNBC, drew comparisons to Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos.
Were there any other occasions where investors were given misleading information, or was that a one-off event?
Becky, I hope and I believe that was a one-off event. I think it's completely inappropriate and not thoughtful, these kind of comparisons to Theranos. You and I both.
Ozy denies some of the allegations, but some of them, like the COO impersonating a YouTube employee, are undisputed. Much like Theranos, Ozy seemed to thrive in a culture of PR and hype until it didn't. And it's not a stretch to wonder how Elizabeth Holmes fits into the larger story, whether she's an anomaly or an indicator of something bigger.
I think that the people who would like to position Theranos as a unique exception will find evidence to make that case.
Roger McNamee spent 34 years investing in companies.
The notion that you could raise hundreds of millions of dollars for a medical testing company run by a person under the age of 30 was something that would have been vanishingly unlikely prior to 2000, but didn't seem out of place in the environment of the first decade of this century.
McNamee was an early investor in Facebook, an advisor to Mark Zuckerberg, a co-founder of private equity firm Elevation Partners, and he was approached early on to invest in Theranos. Today, McNamee calls himself an activist. He stepped away from the firm he co-founded, and he's the author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe.
I realized that the most successful investments coming out of the Valley were all going to have these predatory business models with ridiculous amounts of capital against income statements that might never generate a profit. And that caused me to tell my partners, you know, I've passed my sell-by date. This is not a culture I'm comfortable in. I mean, you guys hang around, God bless. I mean, good luck, enjoy it. I hope it works out well. And obviously it worked out fantastically, but it was not something I was comfortable with.
McNamee says to really understand the culture of Silicon Valley today and how Theranos fits in, you need to look at its history.
I think of Silicon Valley as having had three sociological eras. So that first era, which really ran from 1956 until the late 70s, was dominated by the government as the primary customer. So it was military and space for the most part. We're going to the moon.
And counting, and Apollo 13 is go.
In the 70s, we saw the beginnings of the hippie value system coming into Silicon Valley. It began with Atari.
A world beyond your wildest dreams. Discover Atari.
Was then followed by Apple.
January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh.
And what was really interesting was that the two were surprisingly compatible. You know, as straight-laced as the space program folks were, their idealism and their desire to make the world better with technology meshed perfectly with the counterculture folks that built Atari and then Apple.
Heading into the late 90s, it was also expensive to start a tech company, and there were lots of barriers to entry.
The companies had to spend between $100 and $150 million on infrastructure just to launch a website. And because of that, the average age of the entrepreneurs was pretty old, because you were not going to trust $150 million to a kid.
But after the internet bubble burst in the early 2000s, McNamee says everything changed.
The limitations that engineers had been under for the prior 50 years, which were limitations of processing power, memory, storage, and bandwidth, began to evaporate. So instead of requiring $150 million to launch a product, all you needed was an American Express card or a Visa card. Anybody could do it. And it turned out everybody did.
Everybody did, including Elizabeth Holmes and another dropout from across the country named Mark Zuckerberg. Just as Mark was founding Facebook in 2004, Elizabeth was getting Theranos off the ground. Not only were the barriers coming down, but the culture was also changing, according to McNamee. And suddenly, these young innovators were exactly what investors wanted.
The people making the investments, they were attracted to a certain kind of person who really focused on size, speed, and efficiency. The notion was move as fast as you possibly can, get as big as you possibly can, and don't let any obstacle get in your way. That became the prevailing culture of entrepreneurship in Silicon Valley.
This culture of bold and disruptive entrepreneurship was very much present, according to McNamee, when he says a friend on Theranos's board approached him to invest in the blood testing startup.
I explained to my friend I wasn't likely to do it because I really didn't do healthcare. He said, no, this is so great, you got to look at it. And I go, okay, great, give me the pitch. So he walks me through the slide deck. And the idea was that we were going to take a drop of blood, and it was going to revolutionize medical testing because you were going to be able to identify all these incredibly terrifying diseases. And because it was just a drop of blood, you were going to get people tested way more often, and therefore it was going to radically transform public health. Now, I'm not an investor in medical devices, but I had worked a long part of my career in a firm that was huge in it. And so I had at least been exposed to these companies. And the thing I know is that when you get a blood test, they take vials of blood. And these guys were going to go from that down to a pinprick without any intervening steps. They were just going to do this all in one shot. And I went, huh, I can't speak for medical devices, but I know that in my world of technology, that's not possible, that you have to make incremental approaches and you get there in a series of steps. What's your interim strategy? They go, no, we're going to go straight there. We've broken the code. And I said to my friend, wow, that's something that in my world, I would look at with great suspicion. And he goes, no, we're on top of this. And I go, well, God bless, but I'm not going to do it.
But others did. And McNamee says Theranos played right into the groupthink of the moment.
I mean, it would have been great if it worked, but people started to believe this notion that if you raised enough money and you moved fast enough, success would be a self-fulfilling prophecy, that you would be able to overwhelm any challenge. This is the exact principle that went into Uber, the exact principle that went into WeWork.
There's an argument from Elizabeth's legal team that she couldn't have deceived investors because these were highly sophisticated people. They should have known they were taking a risk. What do you say to that?
I would say she's correct that these people pretend to be highly sophisticated. I think those people allowed themselves to be duped, and that in no way absolves her of responsibility for the things she'd said or things she did. Look, it pays you money and you take your chance. That's the investment business. People lose money all the time, but you're not allowed to lie to people. You're not allowed to pretend you're doing one thing when you're actually doing something quite different. There are very clear laws on that. And Theranos appears to have gone way over that line.
Theranos received some of the biggest checks from the likes of Rupert Murdoch and the Walton family, heir to the Walmart fortune. Not sophisticated venture capital biotech investors. But McNamee believes another fundamental shift worked to Elizabeth's advantage. Interest rates, that is the cost of borrowing, crash after the dot-com bubble burst, and again after the financial crisis. This meant investors had access to free-flowing, cheap capital. And it ended up finding a home in what were promising to be high-growth companies like Theranos.
That philosophy, I can tell you, did not exist until the late 90s. Before that, people were really careful about where they put their money, especially in the venture capital field. I mean, they made mistakes, but beginning in the late 90s, you know, when you started to put the phrase .com in the tail end of any descriptive word for an industry, you know, so pets.com and all that, you know, that was the beginning of fantasy land.
In fact, the amount of money flowing into companies from the venture capital community went from roughly $30 billion in 1990, according to the National Venture Capital Association, to a staggering $220 billion by 2000. Today, those numbers continue to climb to more than $470 billion. And with the trial of Elizabeth Holmes underway, a handful of noted venture investors have recently said Theranos is not indicative of the overall culture of Silicon Valley. I asked McNamee what he thought about this position. He says Elizabeth is unique for some reasons, but he also sees similarities between Theranos' business model, raise a lot of money to do the impossible, that isn't that far off from the rest of Silicon Valley. McNamee doesn't see any of this ending well.
Silicon Valley is an incredibly male-dominated culture. And if I were they, I'd say the same thing, right? You're trying to make Theranos appear to be an exception. And in some ways, it is an exception. But in many ways, it's just the prototype for a lot of businesses that followed it. Now, it had the misfortune of not getting to a large enough scale before the charade was exposed. The thing about Elizabeth Holmes that I look at that gives me great hope for humanity, you wouldn't have had to go back more than 5 years when it would have been impossible for a woman to raise that kind of money, even for a really great idea. But yeah, men had been raising money for bad ideas for a really long time. And I thought, well, there is definitely a silver lining here because I'm really happy to see that women are getting a chance to do this. And I feel that same way about it. If it turns out it was a scam, I'm going to feel the same way about it, which is that that actually represents a form of social progress.
What role do you see the media playing in all of this?
There is a cult of the founder that has developed in Silicon Valley, aided and abetted by the media. And that's relatively recent. It was axiomatic that most big venture firms brought in professional management when they made investment, because the assumption was that they would be putting in the big capital investment and they would need somebody that they knew, trusted, and who had the experience to manage the large amounts of capital. That's no longer the case.
McNamee doesn't see any of this ending well. The entire saga reminds him of an old joke he heard during the dot-com bubble.
I remember it from the 90s, of the little boy who comes home and says, "Mom, I just sold the dog for $1 million. And mom says, "What? You sold Sparky?" And the kid goes, "Yeah, for $1 million. And mom goes, $1 million? You don't even have a bank account. Where are you going to put it?" He says, "Oh, I don't need a bank account. I traded Sparky for $2.5 million cats. That is the world of Silicon Valley today. The price is fantasy. In the end, what you have is dogs and cats. And eventually, we're going to price these things as dogs and cats."
When?
I have no idea. No, I'm old enough that I've given up trying to prognosticate. And I suspect Elizabeth Holmes will be very fortunate in that she'll still be relatively young and people have forgotten who she was, because her story will be subsumed by much bigger, much crazier stories.
So I asked McNamee, is there any one change to the current ecosystem that could prevent a similar situation from coming up again in the future?
A market collapse. That's the only thing. You have to punish everybody who's playing the game today, and you have to punish them all at once. You have to drop the supply of money. You have to, this has got to be a genuine bear market that lasts long enough to, you know, wipe out tons of people. I mean, the people who are investing in Silicon Valley today know no other culture than the one they're in. So whatever it is has to go on long enough that it creates a window for a different culture to develop.
And what does McNamee think will happen if Elizabeth's found not guilty? Will it send other companies a signal they can act similarly to Theranos?
Oh, no, I think that signal's long. I mean, that horse is out of the barn. People are already doing that. And, you know, I don't follow the case closely enough to know whether she's going to be convicted or not. But I would, you know, do I believe that she's guilty? Absolutely. And do I believe that the people who gave her money did poor diligence? Absolutely. Do I believe the corporate partners who worked with her behaved in a way that might deserve its own legal scrutiny? Definitely.
Guilty or not, McNamee believes the emperor has no clothes business model that created Theranos is here to stay until the market fully implodes. Someday, we'll see how true that really is. Coming up on The Dropout, Elizabeth Holmes on trial. Through the course of this trial, we've heard a lot about Theranos' relationship with pharmacy chain Walgreens. Next week, we hear about its ill-fated deal with another major client, Safeway, the ubiquitous supermarket chain with 276 locations in California alone.
Mr. Bird is a business guru, retail legend, and healthcare visionary.
Steve Bird, Safeway's CEO of 20 years, once one of Elizabeth's biggest supporters and highest profile potential partners, takes the stand with damning results.
I had a very close relationship with Steve Bird at Safeway.
Did Theranos ever end up rolling out its services in Safeway stores?
No.
Elizabeth Holmes did not respond to multiple requests for interviews or comment. The Dropout, Elizabeth Holmes on Trial is written and reported by Victoria Thompson, Taylor Dunn, and me. Victoria is the executive producer. Taylor and I are the producers. For ABC Audio, Susie Liu is producer and Madeline Wood is associate producer. Our field producer is Dia Athen. For ABC's business unit, our associate producer is Victor Ordonez and our production assistant is Lane Wynn. Mixing and scoring is by Rob Galang and Evan Viola. Evan also composed the music for The Dropout. Our artwork is by Teddy Blanks at Chips NY and Cedric Honstad. For ABC Audio, Liz Alessi is executive producer. Special thanks to Josh Cohan, Elizabeth Russo, Ian Rosenberg, Eric Avram, and Stacia Deshishku.